Okay, guys, I'd like for you to turn in your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 19. We're going to go to the Old Testament today. 1 Kings chapter 19. And we're getting close to winding down our series here on refocus, dealing with the subtle shifts that happen in our lives spiritually. So let me go back to an illustration I used when I first started out this series. Remember I told you, and you probably thought I was ridiculous when I told it, so I'll tell you it again. Remember, I grew up thinking that I had good vision, would always have good vision, because I remember as a young man being told that I have 20/20 vision. And I thought, man, I'm just going to have good vision. I'm not like others who have to wear glasses and so forth. Well, obviously you could tell that didn't turn out that way, did it? So about 10 years or more ago, I began to realize that something was changing, and it didn't just happen overnight. It was like a subtle thing. First thing that happened was I'm reading my Bible at my desk in my office, and I can't read the words. And that's because I can't read them anymore, because I need bifocals. So I do what a lot of people do, is I went and bought cheaters. Go to Walmart, go to the pharmacy section, figure out which one, and then also buy bigger Bibles with bigger words, you know, letters and so forth, okay, so I can read. Well, I'm still thinking, well, I maybe need bifocals, but I've still got 20/20. I'm doing okay. Well, yeah, 10 years ago, then I'm like driving down the road and it's night, and we're coming up on the exit, and I can't read the signs anymore and the distance. I can't read what that sign says. And it's a big green sign with an arrow saying, that's my exit, and I can't read it. What really got me was when I'm here at the church and I'm preaching, and I look and I see everyone's face, but the people in the back, their faces were blurry. So I couldn't tell what their reactions were, or if they were sleeping or not, or, you know what I'm saying? But I couldn't see. So then I realized there's something wrong here, and I go to the doctor, and I find out you don't have 20/20 vision anymore, George. Okay? So something changed. So I realized I've gotten older. The change has happened. So what do we do about it? Well, I had a choice. And the choice is wear glasses or walk around without it. I can't tell what your faces are in the back there anymore, folks. So, but I chose to have glasses. I chose to take the corrective action. So what we've been doing these last few weeks is we've been looking at, very first week, how far we've shifted. We looked at the first church, asked ourselves some questions about the first church and asked ourselves, are we doing that? Is that who we are as a church? Okay? And the revelation is, no, something is wrong. It's like the eye test. Something's wrong. Something's shifted. So then we looked at what might be the problem, and that is the whole aspect of losing your first love. And you say, okay, we'll just need to regain our first love. No, that's really not it. You've got to go one step deeper. And that is, take a look at what might have caused you to lose your first love. And so we spent several weeks, we looked at spiritual pride, self-sufficiency, that was that first week. The second week was the issue of suffering. That can affect your relationship with God. We've talked about that. The stuff you endure, the stuff you go through, that can affect you. And then last week, we looked at another big issue that can affect us, and that's the whole issue of forgiveness. Being enslaved to someone because they have hurt us, and that changing our view of God. Okay, so we've looked at the issues. So now we've got to decide, what are we going to do? We know there's been a shift. God's word has revealed to us that there's a problem, so what do we do? Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. Because the tendency now is that when you recognize whatever the issue is, maybe it was unforgiveness, maybe it's suffering, maybe it's spiritual pride, you recognize that you've lost your first love. Here's what happens, though. You begin to think that you're the only one going through it. You're the only one who has this problem. You're the only one who is in the state that you're in. Nobody else understands, nobody else comprehends, nobody else is dealing with it. And I'll be honest with you, the enemy would like you to think that you're the only one. But what we're going to look at today is a guy who thought he was the only one. He's Elijah. Probably the greatest prophet in all of the Old Testament. And you're going to see that he's like you and I. That he struggles. So let's take a look at it together. I want you to notice with me, we're going to notice an incident from his life. I would say it's a turning point from his life, and that is chapter 19. We're going to look at the first 18 verses. Here's what the writer of Kings writes. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's." And he lay down and slept under the broom tree. Behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." He arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. There he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the sound, after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. in Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abimadol, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. The one who escapes the sword of Hazael shall Jehu kill, shall Jehu put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. All right, folks, what we're going to do is we're going to use this narrative, this historical account of Elijah, and try and gain some things from him to kind of give us the next step, to kind of move beyond recognizing that there's something not right, and how do we get to where we need to get. So I'm going to break this down into three parts. I'm going to talk about being distracted, and I think we can all understand that when we look at what's going on here. I'm going to talk about being overwhelmed, and yeah, we can be overwhelmed. But then I'm going to talk about the presence of God. So let's talk about, first of all, being distracted. Here's the first thing I want you to notice. It is easy to forget God and to be overwhelmed by an issue. It's easy to forget God and to be overwhelmed by an issue. So let me just kind of remind you. When we're in chapter 19, if you haven't read 1 Kings before, if it's been a while since you've read 1 Kings, chapter 18 comes before chapter 19. Of course, George. Well, when you go to chapter 18, here's what you're going to find there. It is Elijah on Mount Carmel. And all Israel, the northern kingdom, has gathered there. King Ahab is there, and 450 prophets of Baal. And there is a showdown. If you remember the story, they set up altars. And whoever's God will come down and consume the sacrifice on the altar. That God is God to be worshipped. And of course, the prophets of Baal are there, and they're doing their thing all day long. They're cutting themselves, and there's silence. Elijah comes with his sacrifice. He has him douse it several different times with water, prays, fire comes down from heaven, consumes the entire altar, even the stones upon which the altar was made. And everybody bows down to the Lord. The prophets are then killed. After that comes relief from the drought they're in by the big windstorm. Do you think that Elijah saw God that day? Yeah, of course he did. Then immediately you come into chapter 19, and Jezebel, who is the wife of Ahab, sends a message and says, if you're not dead tonight like one of those other prophets, then I'll be dead. Meaning, your life is worthless. And guess what it says? He gets afraid. Now, does that make sense to you? I mean, he was just on the mountain. He just saw God. I mean, think about it. If you and I were there, that would be like wild. I mean, we've seen something like that on TV or something with CGI. But to see fire come down from heaven, consume, and you think you'd be feeling pretty good about your God? But all it takes is just one little thing. And he gets distracted, and he gets overwhelmed, and he just starts, boom, taking off. That's my next point. There is still a desire, though, to seek God, even when that happens. There's still a desire. Now, what do you mean by that, George? Well, it's interesting, because when you look, he's running. So where does he run? He runs to the south. So he's up. Mount Carmel is in the north of Israel. It's in northern Israel. He starts running all the way down to Beersheba, which is in the south of Israel, and he's still heading out. Where is he wanting to go? Well, ultimately, he ends up at Mount Horeb. What or where is Mount Horeb? Well, in the Pentateuch, it's known as Mount Sinai. Now, has that got a special place in Israel's heart? Why is he running there? He's seeking God. So here it is. Okay, folks, let's bring it back to you and I, okay? we recognize something's wrong. The spiritual focus has changed. We've lost our first love. What could it be? Well, you've examined it. Maybe it's spiritual pride. Maybe it's the issue of forgiveness. Maybe it's suffering. Maybe it's something else. But you are distracted. You are overwhelmed. And so what happens is because of that, you are running now. You're desperate, and your relationship's not where it should be with the Lord. But yet, even in spite of that, if you truly know Him, you're still holding out with a hope that somehow God will still help you. And you're still seeking Him a little bit. Maybe not like you should be, but you're still running. You're running to Him, so you're distracted. So that brings the reality, because where are you at? Because when you're in the midst of it, you are overwhelmed. And trust me, Elijah is overwhelmed here. So then we go to that next section, verses 4 through 10. I want you to see three things here. Here's what I want you to see. First of all, look with me at verse 4. When you get to verse 4, it's interesting. He stops and he sleeps under a broom tree. By the way, what is a broom tree, George? Well, it's a tree that you could cut and use as a broom. Okay, so it's a broom tree. He sleeps under the broom tree, and then he awakes. And here's what he says. Look with me at verse 4. But he himself went the day journey into the wilderness and came and sat under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die. So there he is. He's praying, and here's what he's saying. Kill me! Ever prayed prayers like that? Ever prayed prayers like, I can't endure this. It's enough. Kill me! Here's what he says. It's enough. It's enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers. I'm worthless, Lord. You ever been there? I'm sure you have, because you can be in the midst of something and it'd be so overwhelming to you what you're in the midst of, and you're just desperate for something to happen. And you don't know how you're going to get out of it. You almost are on the borderline not even having faith anymore. And you're just saying to Him, God, it's not even worth me going on anymore. Can't you just take me home? This is where he's at. This is where he's at. He's still got that desire. So there is an admission to the Lord concerning feelings of desperation. You've got to be real with Him. You know, when we get done with this series, I've already decided what I'm going to do for the next series. I'll just give you a preview. It's going to be about complaining. Complaining? We're not supposed to do that, Lord, George. Yeah, there's a certain type of complaining you're not supposed to do, but there's another type that it's okay. Because even with a passage like this, can I be honest with you? Elijah is going to be, in a moment here, if he isn't already, he's complaining. He's lamenting. He's pouring out his heart. We all do it, right? I hope you do. Where you say to Him, God, I can't go on. I can't handle this anymore. I don't even know what to do. Why don't you just put me out of my misery? It's okay. So there has to be, in the midst of being overwhelmed, there is an admission to the Lord with your desperation. Here's the second thing we see there, is God sustains the seeker. I'm always amazed when I read this, that here he is, he goes to sleep, he's woken up in the morning, an angel wakes, are you listening to this? An angel wakes him up in the morning, and at his head are hot stones with a pot on it with food and a jug of water. And he just eats it, goes back to sleep. Does that kind of stuff happen to you every day? Like, I woke up this morning and there wasn't an Egg McMuffin by my nightstand. Dude, you know, I had to go downstairs and get a bowl and pour my cereal and get the milk and get my yogurt, you know what I'm saying, and eat my breakfast. I had to do it myself. There was nobody, but this is normal to him. God's sustaining him. Now, okay, don't expect there to be hot coals by your head in the morning, okay? But I'm going to tell you, whether you realize it or not, when you're in this kind of place like where he's at, he's sustaining you. He's sustaining you. He maybe is bringing somebody by to encourage you, say the right word to you. It might be, if you listen to Christian radio, maybe the right song that comes up and brings you hope in the moment. You know what I'm talking about. You've experienced it. I'm not saying something new here. God sustains you. Now, the problem with some of us is like, okay, well, that's really good, George, but I want him to do something big. I want a Mount Carmel experience. I want him to take care of the woman, and there will be no problem. But he doesn't do that, does he? He doesn't do that. But he still sustains you. Sustains you. Here's the third thing. The problem is also is that there is a sense in which there is a conviction that you are the only one. I find this reality to be true with every believer, no matter what they face. That whatever the difficulty is, you think you're the only one going through it. And you're desperate. And so you're like Elijah. It's enough. Take my life. I'm the only one. In fact, that's what he says when he goes down to Mount Horeb. He finds a cave. Now, some Bible scholars believe that the cave that he found is connected to, remember, when God told Moses that I'm going to pass by, but you can only see my backside, and he put him in the cleft of the rock. Some scholars believe that's the cave that Elijah went to. That he went to the very same cave. Why? Because he's seeking God. He needs God. So I want you to notice the presence of God here. And this is the final three things. And this is going to help us. Because as we're talking about getting up and moving beyond and correcting, putting on glasses for our spiritual sight, getting our hearts back to where they need to be, there's some powerful things here I need you to understand. Here's the first one. The Lord does not necessarily respond in the spectacular. Can I say that again? God doesn't necessarily respond in the spectacular. So there he is. He's saying, go out on the mountain, get ready to meet me. And so guess what happens? Big wind comes by, big enough, bigger than what just happened here in our county, ripping out trees, but it's big enough to rip rocks off of a mountain. And the text says, the Lord was not in that. There was an earthquake, but God was not in that. There was a fire, but God was not in that. See, God doesn't necessarily show up in the spectacular. The problem is we want the spectacular. In fact, we want an introduction of angels to announce God's getting ready to do something. You know, we want that, and then boom, God did it, and you're like, whoa, the Lord is God. Wow, thank you. He doesn't do that. Think about it in your life. He doesn't do that. He can. Doesn't mean he can't. He doesn't necessarily choose to do that. Where does he show up in? Well, here in the ESV, it says a whisper. I like the way the Old King James, New King James says a still small voice. Still small voice. So here it is, the second one. The Lord often speaks in a still small voice. So let me talk about a time when I was in desperation. It was connected to the issue of forgiveness last week when I talked about it, what enslaved me, and that was when we were in that church and stuff was going on, people were getting involved. And, you know, I've got a wife and I've got two little ones. We're not getting paid. We're trying to make this thing work. And I am going to the Lord and I am praying. And I'm expecting, Lord, you to do spectacular things like rebuke those who need to be rebuked, Lord, and provide the finances so we can make it, God. And dude, bring the church back. And I'm going to him and I'm talking to him. I'm just bearing my soul. I'm lamenting. But he didn't do any of those spectacular things. By the way, he didn't even pay attention to any of my steps that I gave him to how to handle it. Because we're good at coming up with steps, right? Or take care of this one, take this dude out, do this thing. You know what I'm saying? Take this dude out. Yeah, we pray those kind of prayers, don't we? They're in the Psalms. There are prayers like that in the Psalms. God didn't do any of that, but what he did was gave me peace. An overwhelming sense of peace, a stillness in my soul in the midst of the chaos. But basically he said, George, I'm here. Trust me. Now, did it get better?